Anyhow, we have a lot of building jobs in front of our, we have a new 8-floor classroom and office building that's going up, 2 floors below the ground, 6 above, which is very impressive, lots of buildings with it, lots of noise, and it's supposed to be finished. I think that it was supposed to be pretty close to the fall, but it's not going to be, because it's behind schedule. Then right behind the Constitution Hall itself is a retail, and it's really very exciting. It's a beautiful building. I went through it about 3 days ago, and I was excited when I saw the plans. But we've had a consultant, Frank Anofke from Long Beach, who is very knowledgeable about the student union building, and he maintains, and I think he's really right, it's going to be the outstanding campus activity center in the United States, UNC. It's really an exciting building, has lots going for it, and we've looked at, this committee has met for 6 years working on this building. It's tremendous. We're very excited about it. We also have a new dining hall that is going to join our 3 dormitories that are on the going up toward the upper ridge. We have 3 new dormitories, Moore, Bartlett, and Scarland Hall, and they'll be joined by a common building that will have a commons as well in the lounge, so that they will all be together there. And this common lounge and dining hall is being built, is supposed to be opened about the 15th of November this year, which will make it nice for the kids up the hill, because they don't have to go down the hill to go to meals. And, you know, youth today is not as rugged as we were. So to walk 5 minutes, 6 minutes, 60 below weather for a meal, and back up again, pretty damn tough. Really. And this way they won't have to, they just go outside their room to a warm place and can eat. So we make it easier for our young people.
Make them soft, that's what you do.
That's right. And maybe this is good, maybe it isn't. Personally, I still like to be the rugged type, and I think I am.
Well, they're more ragged, though.
They are.
Speak for yourself,
sir. Anyhow, it's great to be here. And Bill, I'll let you take over, because after all, you've had me for 7 years and you haven't had
Good. Well, you know, Betty, I didn't come down. Give her a big hand. She's one of the greatest arrangers that ever happened. My wife had some trepidations about this joint venture of ours coming to California, too.
I would think so. It'll be all right.
And so did her husband, I'm sure. She's only been married a couple of months. But
yeah.
I don't think they're as confused as the poor girl at the hotel, you see. Because I checked in and I registered for a room on Mr. Cash, and so they assigned me a room, and I said, is Mrs. Clark here yet? No, Mrs. Clark. So then she checks in. As soon as she checks in, she says, is Mr. Cashin in yet? And I said, yes, he's in. What number of room is he in? You know? So then the poor girl at the desk sees us, you know, coming down, and we'll go and have a cocktail together, and having breakfast together this morning. And then we started, and then we started checking out. And Betty goes up to the desk, and she still has her name under Harrop. So her credit card is under the name of Harrop. And so she's up to the desk, and she's handing her credit card, carte blanche or whatever it is. And she chuckles to the cashier girl, and she says, you see, I check in as Mrs. Harrop, and I check out as Mrs. Clark. And, oh, she says, I check in as Mrs. Clark, and now I'm checking out as Mrs. Harrop. And the poor girl was getting more confused all the time, and when she, when I came up to the desk, why, she says, oh, all right, and she just saw, I'm sure, C for cash and everything, And as I was walking away from the desk, she says, well, goodbye, Mr. Clark. And she still doesn't know what's going on.
That was in San Francisco.
Was that in San Francisco?
Yeah, that was
I don't know what the girl's going to do tonight.
Oh.
I don't know whether I can go home or not. At least, I'll tell you, we didn't leave together. We're not going home together. But I really, you know, I came down to listen to your stories, not to listen to mine. But last night I told a story on Marion, didn't I? And I didn't get it on my tape recorder because I was punching the wrong buttons. Do you all know Marion Hall that
yeah,
I were talking about?
Yeah,
she's supposed to be here. Well, I told at the group last night the first time I met Marion, and you might recall some recollections of some of you fellas too. But in 19, I'd been up to the college in 33, and in 35, I decided to go. Well, Bunnell told me, he says, if you want to take a couple of weeks off in August and go down to Juneau and see the folks, I think we could get along without you for a couple of weeks. I didn't think it was possible, but he did. So I went down, and I got to Valdez, and then all the boat was full. And it was at the end of the canning season, and they had about 250 of these Filipino cannery workers going south on the, and they all went steerage. Now, did any of you fellas ever travel steerage?
Yeah, I came up.
Oh, brother, you talk about steerage. But when you get that gang down there, you know, and the food was just awful. And so I ate peanuts, you know, for the day and a half to get to Juneau, and I was pretty green when I got there. Coming back, you see, I get all dressed up. Boy, I'm going first class this time. Well, no more of that steerage stuff. I got over to Juneau and, well, you know, trying to catch passage, and there was nothing available except steerage. Well, I had to get back, you know, so I signed up for steerage again. Well, I went down in the hold, you know, the front of the boat and everything, but then I'd clean up, and I found out how to get up on the main deck, and if you were dressed reasonably clean and walked around, you know, they wouldn't really send you back down into the hold with the animals and things. Well, anyway, this happened to be the school teacher special, and Tommy Campbell was aboard, and a bunch of the professors coming back to the college, and I knew them all. And they introduced me to several new students coming up, and among them was Marion Hall, see? And so I don't know who, Tommy or someone introduced me to Marion Hall, a new co-ed coming up. And this was about the second day out, and I hadn't eaten for 2 days, and I was just starving to death, you know. But I was trying to make a good impression on Marion, you know, telling her about the university and all this and that and so forth and so on. So as we were standing there, this guy with a damn dinner gong came around, you know. Ding, 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 ding. Remember when you travel on the boat? 15 minutes to lunch call, you know, 15 minutes first setting, 15 minutes for lunch, and my stomach turned over because I was so hungry. And Marion says to me, let's take a couple of quick trips around the deck and work up an appetite for lunch. I've never forgiven her for that.
Boy.
My story now, can you go on with the meeting? Oh, well, I got them all in the brochure as I went around ahead. Is there somebody that didn't tell me anything or something? Anybody got a good story that they'd like to put on the tape? I went around, Betty, before.
I think I have three small anecdotes. They're short.
Good. Why don't you come
on? I think that we'll start that portion. Now, I had a question about these. Betty brought these.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I forgot about them. Those are pictures. They're copies of pictures that Ziegler made of Dr. Bunnell. Actually, they're better than the original. And the Alumni Association had them made years ago, and Dr. Bunnell didn't like them. Frankly, I can't say I blame him because they don't flatter him a bit. But we have them, and so I brought them with me and thought that those of you who would like to have them, you're very welcome to them. And I have a supply over there that's enough for everybody who'd like to have a copy of them. There they are. And truly, that's the way he looked, I understand, at that time, because he was a little ill, you know. But I have a photograph of him in my office, which is delightful, and just the way I like to remember him when he did type up like this. But this is a beautiful reproduction. Really is. Did you look at it?
Yes.
It is good, isn't it?
Wonderful.
And I think I saw it at that time. he really does look ill, and he was at the time. But this is a copy of Ziegler's painting, and frankly, I think better than the painting, don't you, Bill?
Yes, the reproduction is better than the painting.
Have you seen the painting at all?
No, I never.
Well, it really is.
The first time.
The Alumni Association, you know, bought that or paid for it. The commission Ziegler
to
do it.
They just found them in the archives, and I said, I'll take them. I'll give them to the alumni who want to have them.
Well, I think there's enough copies for one to go around, yeah. Everybody. You don't want to pack them back home. No.
Pack them home.
No. They're yours.
Right here. I've got news for you.
When was this painted?
1949, and he retired in 49. Now it was painted from a series of Kodachrome slides that were taken of him. But just at this time, Bunnell was really at his poorest health. He was almost dead, you know. And they took these. I think it was Herb Hilscher that got these colored slides. Went down and photographed him at his house, got him out of bed, the poor old fellow, robed him up, and took these pictures and sent the colored Kodachromes to Ziegler. Ziegler put up the colored Kodachromes and painted what he saw. And this is exactly the way Bunnell looked at that time.
We saw him in the fall of 48.
Yeah. That's right.
He looked
just about
very, very
like
thin
that.
And rather gray.
And
he was thin, you know, and sort of... Mm-hmm. Where his weight had been, he kind of draped a little.
Yeah. Right. So that, and then the, this was presented to the university on Emeritus Day, and Butch Butler got up and made the presentation, and we folded the curtains in the back apart to reveal the portrait, and I'll tell you there were some mixed emotions because some people gasped and some people oohed and awed, but they weren't happy with it, you see.
Well, he, in his earlier days, was a very dynamic
yeah.
person.
He was quite
a handsome man.
Yeah.
At about 1935.
I have a photograph of him. It was taken by a very fine photographer in Seattle. That I wish that we had a copy of that for everybody. Because it's really, to me, it's like, you know,
I might put a copy in my book. If you buy the book, you'll get a copy of the picture.
I think one of speaking of anecdotes about him, I think one of the more interesting ones is how he became president of the university. At the time, the university being founded and looking around for a president. Dr. Bunnell was then Judge Bunnell. And my father, along with several others, were asked who they would suggest. And they came up almost unanimously with Dr. Bunnell, later to be Dr. Bunnell. And I think that my father's particular interest was perhaps a little biased, because he being an attorney and Dr. Bunnell being the judge at that time, and they didn't see eye to eye on any legal affairs. So I suspect that my father's boosting of him,
yeah.
of him was, had a little self-interest
yeah.
in him. But it worked out very well.
Pretty well. Well, you know, there was quite some opposition to him, too. I interviewed... Old Bob Bloom, you know, is still kicking around. And he's the last surviving member of that first board of trustees. And so I got hold of Bob the other day and I got a tape. Well, it was a month or so ago. And I said, now, Bob, you didn't want Bunnell to be president, did you? And he said, oh, no, I didn't want him to be president. I said, well, why didn't you want him to be president? He said, well, he wasn't qualified. Wasn't qualified. I said, well, what made you think he wasn't qualified? Well, he said he was only a second grade teacher. He says, an Indian school teacher at that. He says, and you know, Bob still goes around apologizing that he wasn't able to get rid of him right at that first meeting. And it's really funny after all these years. But Bob said that he and Lavery and Snodgrass, those three, they wanted to get rid of him right away. But Stevens, kind of let them down. And Stevens would have been, I think, enough to at least stalemate the thing. But Stevens went over with Nerland and Rickert and Mrs. Hess and that bunch. Not on that first
no, Mrs. Hess was.
Mrs. Hess was.
Right.
But I'm detailing that pretty good because I've got in the archives the copy of the resolution asking for that he be dismissed for the good of the institution. And it's in the handwriting of Bailey, you see. Is that right, Bailey, the grocer?
No.
Robert?
Lavery.
Lavery.
Bailey ran the
truck. Yeah, Lavery. It's on the back of a sales slip of Lavery's store.
Yeah, Lavery.
Is written out, be it resolved that the resignation of Charles E. Bunnell hereby be requested for the good of the institution. And I think I'll reproduce that photostatically. I think this is going to be fun. Well, Gordon, we interrupted your...
Oh, no, that's perfectly all right. Our chapter received a thank you letter from Jean Bunnell Kennedy when Dr. Bunnell passed away. I think it was in San Jose at some hospital up in the San Francisco area. Do you know when he died and where?
1st of November, 1956, was it?
15 years ago, wasn't it the same fall that this was organized?
November 1st, I know it was. And I think it was 1956.
That's the death. I thought it was just a few weeks before this organization was chartered, because you know you wrote to her and asked if he could attend, and before the meeting we heard he had been.
Yes, I wrote a letter to Jean Bunnell requesting that she inform Dr. Bunnell that we'd appreciate having him at our chartered meeting, and she wrote and said he was very ill.
Well, I think, was it 1956, the fall you organized?
October 21st, 1956.
That's correct, then. He died on November 1st. I'm his biographer. What are you?
Right,
who's arguing here?
Well, I have a story, if you want some.
Well, let's see what Gordon wants. I think it would be appropriate for members to tell any stories concerning Dr. Bunnell, and then we can make a round about amusing incidents in Alaska, etc. So if anybody has a story concerning Dr. Bunnell, would you tell it?
Yes, I am. Well, it was on Mother's Day. We were in Unit 6.
What year?
In 1938. And Terry O'Neill and some of the other gals came out and threw a blanket down in Naples. The sun was out, there was snow on the ground. We happened to have a gallon of alcohol. It was only $8 a gallon in those days.
Yeah, Everclear in those days.
But there were six or eight of us in this corner. Well, it was the northeast, is it? Yeah, well, the northeast corner of the Unit 6 there.
Was this the basement of Hess?
The basement.
Yeah, this is what Unit 6 was.
And we opened our window and we talked to the gals and we were drinking this stuff with some lemon juice that we liberated and a little sugar from the commissary and snow. So we started passing these drinks to the gals and they started passing them upstairs. And pretty soon, most of them were pretty well polluted. So that evening, I went to my room, and the rest of the fellas went to town, or most of them did. And I was writing letters, and mine was right under the house mother's room, so we couldn't have a party down there. So we were declared the other end at that time. And the light was on, and judge knocked on the door and said, "Come in." And he said, doctor rather, and he says, "What was going on there today?" And I said, "Oh, we were just having a lemonade party." I said, "Would you care for some?" And he says, "Fine." So So I fixed him up. I put it in quart bottles and cut it down a little bit. And still use snow and water and lemon juice and sugar. Well, you know, and he drank that. I said, would you like another? And he says, yeah. He says, I would. So I fixed him up another. He wiped off his chin, I remember, with his handkerchief. He says, that was a hell of a good lemonade party you had.
That was Dr. John Northrop recalling it. What about what year was that, John?
1938.
1938. That's a good. Holly, did you say you had a story or so?
Yeah. Dr. Bunnell was working one spring, just about the beginning of tourist season, working alongside Unit 5 one afternoon in the garden. And a car drove up, and a few tourists got out, and they walked around the building, and Dr. Bunnell, and they asked him, where's the president's office? And he gave him directions through the Adelson building about how to get where the president's office was. And as soon as they were out of sight around the corner of the building, Dr. Bunnell switched around and went around the other side and went up to his office to greet him.
That's right.
Dr. Bunnell was always very concerned about the welfare of the students and also the expenditure of the university funds for coal, and he was forever going throughout the campus during the winter evenings while I was on campus, closing windows, and he'd go, you could see him walking down the halls and entering rooms and closing windows if the students were wont to leave
fresh air.
Yeah, for fresh air. And of course, you know, the university at that time was on the old power system where they had a one heating unit where they couldn't turn off the in any one room. It was our in a system. And Dr. Bunnell was the saying to me at one time that when the post office, the college post office, was established on campus, that it started out as a fourth class post office, and of course the remuneration for a fourth class office was so little, I think it was something like $400 a year, that it was really very difficult to get anyone to take care of the post office, and even to take the position as postmaster. And so Dr. Bunnell at that time took the title as postmaster, and he held this, he must have taken this title, I don't know when the actual buildings were established on campus, but he must have taken this position as postmaster in the neighborhood in the 1920s sometime. And he held this title until 1947, when I became postmaster of the university. And I believe that when Dr. Bunnell finally retired, even though someone he actually did the duties postmaster, I think Dr. Bunnell drew a pension from the post office department of something like $28 a year.
You're speaking of him going around closing the windows during the early years when I was there. We had a little different situation with the windows. I was going with his daughter at that time, living down in the house down at towards the bottom of the hill, and one of the windows there used to have a view up to his office window in the main building, and Mrs. Bunnell would keep an eye out looking at the office window, and the minute the light went out there, there was quite a exodus from the Bunnell house. Everybody left because he was on his way out.
Bill, this picture
picture of Dr. Bunnell that is far from the vigorous person that most people remember is just about the way I met Dr. Bunnell, because I came on campus in about 48-ish. And I was in a spot because Holly and I tended to be establishment, and the kids at that time were very much, this was, if at the time the earlier story said that there was feeling about Dr. Bunnell, his competency, every day the rumor went out, the university's being closed, Dr. Bunnell's out, Dr. Bunnell's in again, Dr. Bunnell's out. And then there was a lack of money. Would the university be able to stay open until through that set of exams? And we were wondering about units and credits all the time. Meanwhile, we had the same feeling among the students that you have your sort of your radical element today, let's get rid of the president type talk. And we were establishment. So if I didn't understand Dr. Bunnell's popularity, or I didn't know what good he stood for until Holly took a course in law from Dr. Bunnell, and he used to come home every day after that class for lunch, and he'd tell me the stories Dr. Bunnell had told in law class that day, and it was there I could see that he had a sense of where his position in history was, and it came through even though he was an old sick man. There was a real sense of what his destiny had been, and he passed it along beautifully to those that were among his students who were willing to listen to that.
Yeah, I think so.
One thing you have to remember about him was that every year he would, in the early years of the university, he would go down to the legislature and lobby for money for the university. And after the appropriations were passed, it usually was shy so many thousand dollars from what the absolute minimum they could operate on was available. So practically every year he would go back east after the legislative session. And among his friends, particularly in the Pennsylvania and New York area, he would raise the additional money personally to keep the university going. The legislature would maybe appropriate $150,000, needed $200,000 to run, and he would usually manage to dig up the additional money. So it was his own efforts that kept it open for a great many of those early years.
I think you're right. He did have quite a large acquaintance, and he had no qualms about putting the bite on him for a little money for this, that, and whatever he thought was important.
Well, let's say he was a person who believed in his destiny,
yeah,
as you said,
yeah.
And he was working at it every minute.
That's right.
Bill, do you ever talk to Ole Kukla and some of the fellows, the judge in those expeditions?
Not directly, Harold. Not since I've started the project.
You ought to get over and go over some of that with him. I don't remember who else was on that. Was Rolly Snodgrass?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Rolly,
yeah.
Yeah. I remember in the fall of 35, I had an NYA job, 50 cents an hour, 30 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
Worker on the building. I worked in the mineralogy lab and in the metallurgy lab. And he'd come padding around the building, you know, in those slippers that he sort of slushed around in.
Yeah.
And one time he came in, he had a little ivory penguin with his head sticking out of his arm. And I couldn't miss it, you know, he comes in like this.
Yeah.
I said, where'd you get that? He said, the boys brought it back from St. Lawrence. I said, well, they don't have any penguins there. He said, no, I know that. Give me a lecture on the history of the island. I remember too Holly talking about him closing the windows in the fall of 38 when the upperclassmen moved into the women's dorm.
Officially.
Yeah, officially. We weren't down under the hill with his daughter.
Yeah,
we weren't under the hill with his daughter.
Right.
But he came stomping in, must have been about November or December. I remember I had the window open and the radiator was on. And he came in, he didn't knock, he just came in, he strode to the window, he slammed it shut. He said, there's not enough coal in Alaska to keep all these rooms warm with the window open. Turned around, went to the next room. He made all the rounds.
Bill, there's one little oddity that none of you heard after this problem I had had with Bunnell or some of you other people. We lived down in Yurtsville, and this was probably, well, it wasn't really a hippie movement of that day, but it was a little bit off campus. But after I got into the good graces of Dr. Bunnell, he was trying awfully hard to compensate. And he put me on the St. Lawrence Island expedition. I don't remember the name of the teacher. What was the draft teacher? Here, about 35, 36.
Not Hubert.
Hubert.
Yeah. Not Hubert.
And Doc Hubert came in one night with a bunch of maps, and he said that the Bunnell had asked that I draw these maps, and it was Ole Kukala who finally, after many days of foggy weather, had been able to get a new reading on the sun, and it was on this map that I had drawn for Washington, an official map, we had turned the island about 10 degrees. And down in the bottom of the island, there were a bunch of little capes, this and capes that, and so forth. And Huber evidently was trying to butter himself up. He said, now, draw a little bump there and make that Cape Bunnell. In the meantime, I thought, what the hell's wrong with Cape Peacock and Cape Hainer? This is another little story I have to tell.
Do you know whether it's still on the map, Cape Bunnell?
If you look at the official map that we drew, and this was in 1936, you might check it out, because it may be around there somewhere. You might find it in Washington, but we did put a Cape Bunnell.
Yeah, but I know it was on our own maps, our drawn maps, but I was wondering if anybody ever noticed it on an official Coast and Geodetic or Geological Survey map.
Of the vintage of any official corrected map as of 1936.
No, look it up.
Well, anyway, this other thing, this doesn't involve Bunnell, but I've been thinking about it ever since we were going around there, and it involves Betty Harrop, whatever. And she came to one of these meetings, Bill, 4 years ago, and she told a beautiful little story about a mouse in a rain barrel. And as it goes, this little female mouse was in a rain barrel, and it was running around and around, and pretty soon it met a little male mouse, and she said, would you please help me get out of this rain barrel? And the little male mouse says, sure, if you sleep with me. So the female mouse slept with the male mouse, and the next morning the thing was still in the rain barrel. And the next day, this happened again. So the male mouse again approached the female mouse, and she says, well, I'll help you get out of this rain barrel if you please sleep with me. Well, the second day, the mouse was still in the rain barrel. Well, now, the thing ended with Betty asking us, she says, well, now, would you like to know how that little female mouse got out of the rain barrel? She says, well, if you come and sleep with me tonight, I'll tell you.
Now, the punchline is, since she remarried and somebody is sleeping with her, just tell us.
He's still in the barrel.
Well, what a memory. It doesn't pay to
timing, but I would like to tell you something that is one story was, if you remember, Harcourt Palmer and South Pole. What was South Pole tonight? Harkey Palmer and South Pole. Remember the boy that was with Bird Expedition came up and he was down there with Bramhall? And then came up South Pole. What's his name?
Miller was his name.
South Pole Miller.
Okay, South Pole Miller. Okay. Southport Miller and Barney lived in Unit 5, and they were screwing around and kind of found things up. And we decided, okay, we'll get with them. So I don't know who was all involved in this, but at any rate, we, this night, while they went to town, we proceeded to collect newspapers, and we shredded these newspapers, and we filled this room half full of newspapers, shredded, half full. Now, this was a big project, see? And so these guys came home 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, stewed blue, and proceeded into the room, so there's nothing to do, but they couldn't find their beds, or it had already been stacked, see? But, so they flopped down in the newspapers and went to sleep, and this was on Saturday night. On Sunday morning, there was some dignitary came to the campus who the Prexy had to take them around to show them how students lived on the campus. And for some reason, he walked into Unit 5 and walked up and picked Harcourt Palmer's room. And so he opened the damn door, the paper fell out, here's these two characters out here, passed out completely, and he says, I think we chose the wrong room, I think we should. I thought this is very characteristic.
Very good.
That has to do with the mouth, Lord.
Well, you tell us about the mouth.
Well, I don't know about the mouth, but you said it had a correlation. I don't get it.
No, I was talking about the Prexy. The Prexy wasn't a mouse, I know this.
No.
I can think of one other incident that occurred in Unit 5. We were having a party. I forget what occurred. But at any rate, everybody was kind of inebriated. This was, again, I forget who even lived there. I forget the name of the boys now. But anyhow, at this stage, we were having this party. And as you remember, Unit 5 steps went up from the post office. And the upper deck there. There were 6 or 8 people I know. Leo Shirella was one. What were the boys left right off of the hall there? The two brothers. I forget the name. At any rate, we had this party and we were going good. And we started singing old songs and so forth. So we started singing By the Waterfall.
Harry Palmer Hill Brown.
Okay. You're with it. And so we started singing By the Waterfall. So some of the crowd decided that in order to make this realistic, we should have a waterfall. So here's the steps, goes down into the post office, and we got a couple of tubs. I don't know whether we got these tubs. But we got the tubs and had them up there. And then as we stood by the rail and sang By the Waterfalls, a couple guys dumped the tubs down the steps. At this time, while the water was flowing, the Prexy walked in to get his mail.
She walked in, the water hit him, you know, and ran up over his shoes.
He looked up, had a questioning look in his face, walked over, and he got his mail, and he walked back out, and he didn't say a damn. I think this is characteristic of him. And then the people that had the laundry at the time, Cornette's,
yeah.
We were at one of these meetings, one of these parties that we had.
Mother.
What is the name?
Gertrude Cornette.
Gertrude Cornette. And they had the laundry. And this was the night, under these steps where we poured the water, was the place where they had shelves, and the laundry was back under here, and you had the shelves. This is where they stored all the white shirts, and they had all the white shirts on the campus, been pressed, and as we poured the water down, it leaked through the steps and screwed up all the white shirts. So at one of these parties, I hadn't seen her, you know, like for 20, 25 years, and she came to this party and was introduced, George Dickey, and she said, oh yes, you're the one.
Yeah.
She remembered
after
me by
20 plus years, yeah. Oh.
But I think this is a characteristic of Prexy with everything that he had to tolerate and all the screw-ups that we did. He looked at this very philosophically. And the other thing was the breaking of the walls. They had a price on a wall was priced out at, I don't know what this was, $2.50 a square foot. And in any of the dormitories, if you got rowdy and broke a wall, was $2.50 a square foot. So the boys, what were the boys named that lived?
The Smith Gang. Right, I remember that night. They were all stinko.
We had these fights with these guys, you know, the various fugitives. So these guys go in and lock themselves in the room. So we go up and we decide we want to get them to prosecute them for whatever they've done. And so we figure out, okay, here's two studs. This is 32 inches. It's so high. We draw a line on the wall, and you've got two sides to this damn thing. So this is
about a $15 bill,
$0.28 or something for each side, and $15 is a price. We all put the money on the line, and then we bust the damn wall out when we're going to get the line. The next day, the carpenter comes, we go around and tell him, hey, we got a wall to repair. So he comes back, and he cuts it out and puts in the patch, and we pay the price.
This was all above board.
Nobody heard.
Oh, dear.
Dormitory, you could see how many parties they had. 10 high, cases of beer when the snow melted, bottles all over the place.
Say, Bill, get Butch Butler to tell you about the time one morning after a fresh snow when he walked up the stairs on the end of the girls' dormitory backwards.
Oh, yeah, I heard that.
And then walked back out to the sidewalk again in his own footsteps. So remember the name of that gal who was the in the women's dorm?
Evans, maybe?
No, the little
Let's not make names.
Little plump one.
Mrs.
The
Evans.
The gal in charge of it before Mary Jo Bramhall. That was Evans.
Evans.
And she almost had a fit trying to figure out those footprints on something.
Just going away, huh? The only footprints are out. Apparently, we're.
And he walked out again.
that was started many, many years before when there were just the two dormitories, the men's and the women's dormitory. And I can't remember her name, but she later married Noah Ween, and she had the room up at the top of the fire escape. And every time there was a fresh snow, there was a one-way.
Preston girl?
Could have been. I don't think so. But there was a one-way set of steps. Clear up the fire escape always.
Very confusing.
I don't know if Bill did Doc McDowell get into the act on the time that somebody in the men's dorm had a brick of Limburger cheese. And I don't know what really happened here, but the way it went on, something happened and the Limburger cheese fell behind the hot radiator.
Right.
And after a lot of scuffling and getting it out, they flipped it out the window, but it was midwinter. The thing fell down to the window below of the men's main dorm. And then everybody forgot about it, but when spring came,
the whole story was all over the dorm again. You could smell it. Maybe you were in on that more than we
did. I don't know.
Yeah, I remember one. In the spring of 36, after breakup, when the sun started getting warm again, we were waiting to go into supper one night. We used to mill around the sidewalk on the dorm. And one evening, the judge came over from the main building and he stopped. There were half a dozen of us standing there in the group and he stopped. Just talked, let the conversation go. When it got to the point he wanted, then he brought his story. and he was telling about how he'd argued with Colonel Olson on the railroad about the purpose of the railroad. He said he told the colonel that the railroad was the defense of Alaska. And the colonel said, no, it's to help develop the territories. And they argued and argued. He said, and finally I gave the colonel my argument. He said, that put an end to the argument. He said, I told him that it was for defense. And the colonel said, well, I don't see how it can be. He said, well, look at it this way. He said, when the Japanese take over Seward, and they go to the railroad station, they price a ticket to Fairbanks, they're going to turn around and go back to Japan.
This is about the... Yeah, that sounds typical. This was quite a long time before the Japanese actually tried to invade us.
They were selling scrap iron then to the Japs.
Yeah, that's right.
They used to come in and load up with old Alaska railroad steel at Seward.
Yeah.
We turned it.
Yeah.
No, Dr. Bunnell had one rather interesting thing happen to him. I think before she came out to Stanford for 1 year, his daughter Jean had a room in the dormitory. And that year they had hired this new, I think she was a teacher, who also was supposed to be the matron of the dormitory. And going in there in the fall, she went through all the rooms checking over the women's dorm, and she came to this one room where the bed was sort of diagonally across the corner, and she figured that was a little odd, so she thought she'd look over at what was behind, and it was a marvelous collection of empty bottles. And so she immediately rushed down to Dr. Bunnell, pointing out that there was something going on in this dormitory that was pretty bad. There must be some terrible people in there. And she had found this one dormitory room that had this tremendous collection of bottles. Dr. Bell trying to maintain the decorum of the things that, and whose, what room was it? And the new matron mentioned the name, and Dr. Bunnell sort of reared back and said, that is my doctor's room.